This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 136. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all around the world, for just about every continent on the planet. And we are all here virtually together in our little camera club, ready to have our weekly dose of photography knowledge. We have a ton of listener questions to go over this week, and I have Darren Meller and Jeff Harmon on the line to talk about today's topics. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Well, let's jump right into our first question from Eric Frame on Facebook. So we started our Facebook group just a couple weeks ago, and we already have over 400 people in there. So that's not our Facebook page. We have a huge Improved Photography Facebook page. So on Facebook, search Improved Photography Podcast, and that'll get you on our little private Facebook group. Yeah, you'll request approval, and then one of us will see you, make sure you're a human being, and then add you to it. And it's been so fun. We've been getting tons of different questions in there and connecting with readers. All of the hosts of the podcast are reading every single thing you post in there. So it's been pretty cool. Eric Frame asks, I have a question about printing. I'm trying to get a print to match my screen as closely as possible, but he's just not getting the results that he wants. So he's using an iMac and he is calibrating the screen with the Spider Express. And that's the same one that I use. I think Darren, you use the same one. Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
And so it's a little device that actually, you know, you actually physically put it on the front of your screen and it blinks a whole bunch of colors, red, blue, green, bright, dark, gray, black, a whole bunch of colors for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then it creates a custom profile to make your screen match exactly the colors that it should be. And it even takes a reading of the ambient light in the room so that it can get your screen looking exactly perfect so that when you print, the colors look just right. So he is calibrated. He's shooting in Adobe RGB color space. Adobe RGB is a bigger color space. It covers a much wider gamut than sRGB, which is much more common. So that's fine that he's shooting in it. He's downloading a printer profile for the lab. So each printer is going to be just a little bit different because this is not an exact science. I mean, it's just kind of a personal taste thing how a print exactly comes out. And so that's where the printer profile comes in. It allows you to tweak your screen even a little bit more to know exactly what the file is going to match how it comes out on that specific printer. I don't usually use printer profiles. It usually causes problems in my experience, even though it's supposed to help. Usually when I have a good printer, I'm calibrated and I export in the right file, I have not had problems. So I've tried printer profiles, but strangely, it's caused more problems than it solved for me personally. How about you guys? Do you use printer profiles?
I've tried them before too. I printed a lot through Costco and they do offer their profiles online. You can go download them. They don't update them there very frequently, and that's a problem because that it changes a lot. As like temperature changes, their printer profiles change with the inks. So that they're not updating them very much. But the thing that's most disturbing about using printer profiles is it makes the pictures look really strange on your computer.
Yeah, it does.
So you can't share if you exported them against using the printer profile. You're not going to want to share those on Facebook or email or anything with customers. And in fact, if you sent them out to clients as saying, hey, I use the printer profile for you to print it, they might look at them like, ooh, these are terrible. What'd you do to these things? So I agree. I'm not really going to be using printer profiles anymore. I've tried it a little bit. It didn't seem to mess up any prints that I did, but boy, they look strange on the computer.
Yeah, I totally get the point of the printer profile. Like, it totally makes sense. And if I were printing the photos myself, I'd probably want a profile for exactly my printer. But I find that the good labs out there are working so hard to make it look right with just sRGB on a calibrated screen that it's really not necessary when you're printing with a good printer. When I print to ProDPI or Miller's, my prints are coming back exactly like my screen. And so I don't mess with it. But I totally get the purpose of it as well. Okay, then he says he exports with either Adobe RGB or sRGB according to what the lab wants. So again, Adobe RGB is a better color space. It's just all around better, but it's not as well recognized. Almost everybody is printing with sRGB. Every photo that's posted on the web should be sRGB. And so I would not export Adobe RGB because it's just so different from what everybody else is doing. I don't think that that's right. And I mean, just about every lab I see wants sRGB, not Adobe RGB, when you go to when you're saving your file out. So the way that you do that is in Lightroom, you can do this, or in Photoshop, when you know, you have your raw file and you're saving it out, it'll have a box there that you can, a drop down that you can say what color space you want this to be in, and you can pretty much just leave it in sRGB. It's going to be the very best. It's certainly what you want when you post your photo online, but also for printing, it's what you usually want. So he's doing all those things and he's still having issues. So at this point, it looks like he's following a lot of right things. At this point, I would look at some things like what environment you're actually editing in. You know, is the room you're editing in overly dark, overly bright, or there are lots of weird colors going on in the room, something like that. That's really the last thing that I would point to here. Everything else looks like he's doing right. Any other mistakes that you're seeing here, guys?
Reprofile,
do the calibration with the SpiderExpress pretty frequently, every month or so. It changes over time. The electronics and things that just burns in different, and your environmental light changes with the seasons. So recalibrating, maybe just before every time before you do a edit process, recalibrate, and then go do the edit.
Yeah, I think that's a solid recommendation. But I would also contact Datacolor because they're, and also Google, to see whether or not there's any issues with the spiders. I mean, it's a company; it makes a great product, but there could be a one-off out there every once in a while that just isn't calibrating correctly. If you've already ruled out the environmental things that Jim pointed out.
Good question. Well, Robert asks, I'd like to know, Jim, what you do with PEC pads when you're cleaning your sensor. PEC pads are one-time use wipes that you use to clean the sensor or a lens on the camera. Darren, how do you use your PEC pads on the camera?
I used to just put it around my finger, like a little ghost, when we put a rubber band and said, look at the ghost around Halloween. I don't know if anyone else did that, but I did when I was younger. But anyway, I would just reach in there with my finger, but I'd notice that I'd get my PEC pad caught on some of the abrasive parts of the inside of the camera, like where the diodes and everything connect. So I went and got my camera cleaned in Chicago at a conference, and I noticed that they used a popsicle stick, and he just used a piece of I scotch tape, put it around it, and then moved it around in there just gently to have the PEC pad only touch the sensor, and thus I wasn't getting any more fuzzies in between the sensor, the mirror, and the lens, and that seemed to work out pretty well.
Good idea. Karen Bruchel, I murdered your name there, Karen. She asks, I was listening to the podcast discussions on photo bags, and I'm looking for a carry-on roller bag, and I'm wondering if you guys have a recommendation for a good carry-on. She's wondering about some of the Think Tank bags, especially the Roller Derby. What do you think?
I think she should wait for Brian's review on these. he's working on this very thing. He's going to be talking about carry-on bags. I'm not sure that he's doing roller bags, but at least travel bags, he's doing a review on those.
Yeah, definitely something to look at. I will say that if you're looking for a carry-on roller bag, you're gonna end up with a Think Tank if you want the good stuff. There are lots of good options out there, but this is like their specialty. This is where Think Tank shines, is their carry-on roller bags. They make the best stuff. You may also look at like the Airport Express, airport security bags that they make. They make a lot of great ones. I don't love the style of a lot of the Think Tank bags because they just look really like businessy. It doesn't have any style, no personality to them. I like a bag with some personality, but for a roller bag, for a carry-on, perfect. I would definitely go with Think Tank. Al Ricardo asks about the best close-up filters or extension tubes or lens reversing options for macro photography on the cheap, something cheaper than a dedicated macro lens. Al, I have exactly the video that you need. I bought 8 different lenses. So I bought a Bellows for macro photography that, you know, looks like an accordion, you know, that kind of accordion. It looks like an accordion that goes between your camera and the lens, and it just extends. And the further you put the lens from the camera, the closer you can focus. A reverse ring, you actually take the lens and you actually turn it around backwards, so the front of the lens is facing the imaging sensor and the back element of the lens is facing what you're shooting. And it's just a ring that will connect on the filter thread of the camera and then mount to, or filter thread of the lens and then mount to the camera. Those are an option. But the Bellows is really annoying to use. I mean, they're just super clumsy to use, takes forever. And the reverse ring, it's okay, but there are better options out there. I often find light leaking in the reverse ring. Just a lot of problems with those reverse rings and getting sharp results. Some people do it, will have a good setup, but I didn't get great results when I tested it. Close-up filters are a decent option. The Canon 500D is the one that I like the best. So it's from Canon. Yes, it works just fine on an Nikon because this is just a filter that screws on the end of your lens. And the 500D is a good one because it works better with longer lenses. Something like a 100, 150 millimeter lens is going to be great with a Canon 500D. The close-up filter works decently well, but I got the very best results by using extension tubes. I tried the Kenco extension tubes that everybody uses, and they're very expensive. They're very well regarded. And I got the best results with extension tubes that just cost $20. So go to improvephotography.com/extension tubes, and I have a full video there where I'm taking a picture of a little frog, and I'll show you all the different options and give you my recommendation. All right, Tim Evans asks, I sent the marketing director of a local golf course some HDR photos that I took at a golf course, and I was just wondering if they'd be interested in buying them. Well, it just so happens that they were revamping their website, and they said they're interested in buying some of the photos. So how do you go about figuring a fair price? What do you guys think?
He also mentioned in the Facebook group that he's a hobbyist. So that's part of the reason he's asking the question is he's like, I've never even sold a print before or any rights to my photos. So what's a fair price?
This happens every time somebody gets a request the first time to buy a photo. It's like, I don't know what to charge. It's like this panic moment. So what would you tell them?
Well, I tried to, even in the Facebook group, I took a chance at trying to answer the question and I overcomplicated it. So I would follow Jim's advice. He just said, hey, a good going rate right now is $100 for rights to put it on a website.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair price here. You could charge more. I'm sure you could charge less too, but $100 is probably what I'd ask for it. Darren, what would you charge for something like that?
As much as they're willing to pay. And I would just try to just feel it out. I'd just be like, all right, well, maybe $200. And then if they just kind of back away and, you know, then I'd say 100 or go to 150, but try to get more out of it. I mean, it could get you a piece of gear that you're looking for.
There you go. All right. Erica asks, has anybody else had issues with the YN560 battery life? She says it's shooting fine while she's shooting, but then overnight it loses charge. So it's the not standby, but when the battery's off, when the flash is off, it's just draining the rest of the battery. Have you guys had any issues with this, Darren?
I haven't had any issues with it. And I thought at first when I was reading the question that it was standby mode and she was just leaving the flash on, and that definitely would explain it because it's just a power reduction system. But it could be that for some reason the flash just isn't completely powering off, so I would just pull the batteries. I don't think that any of my flashes have done that, but in my use case, I don't travel with my flash batteries inside the Young Nuos. I just leave them in the separate battery case and then plug them in there, so I know I have 100% charged batteries and not have to guess where I left those batteries with a remaining charge should I have, you know, back-to-back shoots.
Yeah, I do the same. I don't keep them in the flash until it's time to use them. Same with any of like the intervalometers, they are always on. You can't turn them off usually, so I always take the batteries out when I'm not using it. Plus, if you use rechargeables, that would be another way to deal with this, is you have two sets of the rechargeable batteries, then again you probably don't want to put them in until it's time to use them on the shoot. So you charge them up, stick them in your camera bag as you go out for the shoot, don't forget them, and then you have them ready to go.
I've actually had issues with the YN560, the original YN560, with this very same thing. And it can happen with many other electronics. I used to have a constant light that would do the same thing, that you'd use it. When you stopped using it, it still had, half a battery. It still had plenty of power. And then you leave it for a couple days, totally turned off. You come back and the battery's drained. So it has some kind of power leak in the device. The original YN560, I always had this problem. With the YN560s2s, they had already fixed it for me. YN563s and 4s, I've had no issues at all. So if this is the original YN560, I hear you. I had the same problem when I was using those. And the solution you guys came up with is exactly what I would do as well. Just take the battery out. But it is annoying. I always leave batteries in my stuff, so that would drive me crazy. All right. Well, we have had a ton of questions from our readers, and we want to get on to our 5-minute talks of the week, different subjects that we want to get to this week. But I want to take a minute and thank Animoto for their support of the Improved Photography Podcast. Darren, I know you've been using Animoto this week. How did it go?
It went really well. I was able to just drag and drop photos. I thought that I had to shoot little video clips with my phone, and I could have incorporated some of them, but I threw them in there, and it was just beautiful. It came out with a more impressive looking slideshow than I've ever seen. And it wasn't really just a slideshow. It was actually something that made me feel like a sappy, wussy man, because I came to tears when I watched the end of the video. I was in love with it.
Was this a wedding video, or what kind of project did you use it on?
It was a wedding video. I did it as a surprise for a couple for a wedding that I shot on the 25th of July and just posted it, and they're extremely impressed with it. I think that if I was with them right now, they'd be blown away.
Oh, that's really cool. And again, we've mentioned this before on the podcast, video is the best marketing tool out there right now. I mean, it's just going crazy on the web. When you search things on Google, so often it's a YouTube video that's the result. On Facebook, just pay attention the next time you're on your Facebook feed, how much of the content is video. So it's a great way to get the word out about your photography, because it gets shared like crazy, to let people know that you're a photographer and you're available for work, or just to share your love of photography and let your friends enjoy it and see what kind of things you're doing. Animoto is the best way to make a slideshow of your photography, and you can include your video clips in there. They have really high class music in there. Just sounds excellent, very professional. It's not just your standard slideshow fade between every slide. I mean, it's really professional and designed to look the very best that it can. Visit animoto.com/improve and use promo code IMPROVE to get 15% off an annual pro subscription. That's animoto.com/improve using promo code IMPROVE. They also have a free trial, so you can test it out there and see exactly what we're talking about. And thank you to Animoto for supporting the Improved Photography Podcast. We really do appreciate that. All right, we want to get on to our 5-minute segments of the week, and I will toss the first one over to Darren.
All right. Mine is about shooting with an assistant that you trust. And I talk about portrait photography quite often on the Portrait Session podcast, but I am really fortunate to be able to shoot with my father, who I think he will actually be one of the best people to shoot with, out of anyone I could imagine shooting with. And I'm going to try to have him on an upcoming episode of the Portrait Session podcast, just so we can discuss that dynamic that we have. And believe me, there are benefits and there are drawbacks of shooting with your father. I mean, I know where he's at all the time. I can't just, call him and say, hey, are you going to show up to this wedding or show up to this gig? I know where he's at and I know what he's doing, and I can trust him. So that's one of the benefits. A drawback, though, is that we kind of think the same on some subjects, so it causes us to butt heads. And oftentimes when we're out on photo walks with Jim or in workshops or even on shoots, we keep it professional, but people say that we act like we're brothers. Like, we'll actually butt heads on things, and we'll make fun of each other. And
it's true. You two do bicker. I've noticed it.
We're almost like a married couple. It's just like, I swear that, my dad and I are going to be sitting on rocking chairs 30 years from now, and we're going to be sipping on cider, and we're just going to be bickering at each other about the dumbest things in the world. And it's hilarious, but it's a great dynamic to be able to shoot with someone that you know and you can actually convey things with. But another drawback is that it's really hard to convey that you've done something wrong. Like, we were shooting this wedding and he flipped his camera over from C1, which is custom mode on the camera for our flash setup, our go-to one, to bulb mode. And in bulb mode, yeah, it blew out the shot. And I was like, oh man, why did you do that? And
so tell us, for the beginners out there, tell us about what bulb mode is.
Bulb mode is it's a mode where you can actually hold down the shutter button. And as long as you're holding that button down, it'll actually keep the shutter open for as long as you want to. And we did that for a first dance shot, and the sky looked gorgeous, but then I looked at the picture a little bit closer and did some pixel peeping, and I noticed that the faces were blown because we had, you know, kind of a rear curtain sync type thing going on in the photo, and I was just like, oh no, this is the first dance shot. How are we going to do this? So luckily...
You were really dragging the shutter.
Oh, really, really dragging the shutter. I think it was maybe a 5-second shutter with a flash going off, and it was beautiful in the background, but the couple looked so blurry, and luckily I was like, all right, I'm going to keep my cool. And we're going to ask the couple just to step back on the floor real quick and act like they're dancing. And we were covered with grace. So that was just kind of neat to be able to just say, you know, he's my dad. He makes mistakes. I make mistakes. And he's overlooked a lot of the mistakes I made when I was a kid. So, hey, you know, I should give him a break every now and then. So my main point is find an assistant that you can trust. It doesn't have to be your dad. Doesn't have to be your significant other. But find someone who you can count on, rely on, and be able to have that diverse conversation about your work, your path of where you're going artistically, and what you see yourself doing in the world of photography.
Well, very cool. Well, Jeff, I'm looking forward to your 5-minute segment because I am headed out right after this podcast ends to go shoot the meteor shower.
Me too, me too. Yeah,
it's kind of ironic. I'm a little bummed because here in Utah, in Salt Lake, I got clouds tonight. So.
Aww.
So I'm giving a tip I probably can't do tonight. All right, so the rock we all live on happens to be going through like the biggest meteor shower time frame that we have all year. And it's the Perseids meteor showers, what it's called. It's called Perseid because it kind of centers around, or most of the meteors can be seen if you're looking towards the Perseus constellation. So that's why it's named that. And there's a comet that goes around, goes all the way out beyond Pluto and around the sun and back. And it hasn't been very near Earth, but every time it loops around, it leaves a whole bunch of cosmic dust out there. And we hit through it every August. The Earth goes through that. So it can have as many as 50 meteor streaks in your, that you could see. Look like shooting stars, of course, in an hour, if it goes well. And right now, this week, the week of, what is it, August 12th, August 11th, is the peak time to try to see it. So hopefully you can all get out there and try it. There's good information about kind of how to find it at earthsky.org, and we'll put a link in the show notes for it. Nick Page also did a really good Photo Taco episode on this to talk about kind of his setup and how he would do it. But just to cover the basics, got to have a tripod because you're going to need to take like exactly the same shot over and over and over and over and over through the night. You're probably going to want an intervalometer because it's most likely you're going to need to take shots for hours to try to get enough streaks to make it really interesting or even capture one. Because even though there's 50 in an hour, that's only 50. And your 2-second shot to catch it is not very often. So you're going to really need to take a bunch of shots to try to get it. Shoot really wide. Try to get as much of that night sky as you can. Probably going to need to go really high ISO, 3200, 6400 or higher. And then Nick's advice that I hadn't thought of, which I was really glad to hear, so you should go listen to that Photo Taco episode, was to, because the meteor streaks are much brighter than the stars, it's good to take 2 to 5 second shutter speeds so that they will really show bigger than the stars rather than 25 or 30 seconds that you might try to do if you were doing like a Milky Way or a night starscape kind of shot. So then the last tip would be editing it. So unlike stars, other starscapes you might try to do in Photoshop or other times where you're trying to bring out the whites a lot, and you might stack a bunch of layers together and just have the light show through, use the what's that called, the merge mode between the layers so that the light will get enhanced between the layers. That's not going to work well here because if you have a whole bunch, let's say you end up with 20 shots that have streaks in them, meteor streaks. If you go to put those together, the stars will have moved enough that it's just going to be this crazy star-streaked thing with too many stars out there. So you're going to want to probably manually mask in the meteor streaks on one central shot. So you'll probably want to take one shot at like 25 seconds that gets the stars real good, and then layer on top of that the ones that have the meteor streaks and mask in just the meteor streaks. That would be my tip for how to shoot that.
Yeah, that's great advice. And the reason that this meteor shower particularly is supposed to be a good one, I'm hoping that it is that there's no moon right now. I mean, the moon is basically invisible on this day of the month. It's when the moon is darker, obviously we get to see more of the stars. Their stars are not as drowned out. You know, when you have a full moon, it's hard to see any stars in the sky. And so when we're doing star photography, we always want there to be, you know, no moon in the sky. And so we have that and this meteor shower. And so it's not very often that those two line up. And so it's a pretty exciting time. Right now for me, there's a huge wildfire that just broke out 2 days ago. And as soon as I saw the smoke billowing over the city, I thought, oh no, you're going to ruin the meteor shower. But I found a city kind of out away. It's going to be a ways drive, but I can get past the smoke. And so I'm really excited to shooting it. We have clear skies, so I'm ready to get out of here as soon as we're done here and go record. It's on my wife's bucket list of 50 things to do in life.
Oh, cool.
To see a meteor shower, and so I'm pretty excited. Hope it works out.
It does
out.
Require some patience. I know I tried last year. I went out three nights in a row, and I didn't see a single streak, meteor. So it's not, you know, it's not terribly predictable. This is just the maximum chance for it to happen. And that's really clear on earthsky.org. They make that like ultra clear. Like, hey, it's don't get mad at us if you don't see any, because it's just by chance whether or not we get them.
Keeping my fingers crossed. All right. Well, what I want to talk about in my 5-minute segment is rescuing a memory card. File this away, because it will happen to every photographer if it hasn't already. No matter how careful you are, no matter what good practice you put in, it's going to happen that you're going to have a card corrupt on you. It's only happened to me twice ever. I retire a memory card after a year of use. It's out. It's out of circulation. I smash it and put it in the trash. I told that to my sister-in-law, and she says, what's into my way? but yeah, after 1 year, a memory card is done for me, and I never shoot anything vitally important on a brand new card. So yeah, you know, after a card has had a burn-in period of a week or two, a card is either going to fail right away or it's going to fail later on. It's rare that it's going to fail on you in the interim. So we've talked a lot of times on the podcast about best practices, you know, never formatting the card on the computer, always doing it on the camera, et cetera, et cetera. But it can just happen. And it has happened to me twice. It happened a little while ago, and it is horrible. It always happens at the worst imaginable time for this to happen. So I want to give you a couple tips that can help you once you get to that point. The first is buy a professional grade memory card. Not necessarily because it's any more reliable. It may be. I'm not really sure. I haven't done enough testing. I haven't had enough failures to say that it for sure is. But when you get a professional grade memory card from Lexar or SanDisk, there's a little tiny paper in the packaging of your memory card. Keep it. Don't lose that thing. And just put it in a drawer that you know you can get to. Or one thing that I do is if you write on your memory card the date that you bought it, just when you open up the memory card, take a picture of that little piece of paper that has your serial number. And then when your card dies, you can look at the card, you'll see the date on it, and then you can go back into your Lightroom to that date when you open the memory card, and you know that's where you have your serial number. So there are a number of free options as well. But what happens is your card, no matter how many times you erase it, format it, still has that data on there. And so what this software does is it ignores the table that will tell the memory card where each photo is stored, and it just goes through the entire card trying to find the individual files. And often I find when I have had to rescue a card the photos are still there. They just weren't showing up on the table because part of it got corrupted. And so be sure to keep that software and run it. And when you do, you will rarely get every photo back from your shoot, but you'll usually get most of the photos back from your shoot. You'll find it's kind of random which ones survive and which ones aren't found, but be sure to check that. And then one last tip. After you've run the software, it'll find a whole bunch of files that you can see. I mean, you'll be amazed what's on there. Photos from a year ago will still be on the card, and you'll think, how is that even possible? But it happens. And then you'll see some files that will be in a strange format, or you'll try to open it in Photoshop, and it will try to open it, and then it'll just say, I can't open this file. Well, what I would suggest at that point, if you really need those photos, is go download a couple dumb photo viewers. I mean, free, just shareware online photo viewers. And often, if you try five or six of them, you'll eventually get to one that will open the picture. Because some of them, especially Photoshop, is a little bit too smart for its own good. And so if there's a file that's not quite perfect, there's a little string of data missing in it, Photoshop will read through the whole thing and it says, ah, something's wrong with this, I can't open it. But if you get some of the dumb, cheap photo viewers, they're a little bit more likely to skip over some missing things, and some other programs will open it up. So if you ever run into that problem, just file this away. Those are some tips to help you get all the data off those cards. Have you guys had problems with corrupted memory cards?
I have never had one be corrupted yet.
Whew, keep your fingers crossed. How about you, Darren?
I have once with the PNY cards, but they sent me some new ones and I haven't had any issues. But it was weird because it only happened when I was importing into Lightroom. It's just like, yep, Lightroom just kind of said, nope, this card's done.
Yeah, it's terrifying when it happens. When I'm shooting a wedding, every 15, 20 minutes, I am passing one card off to my wife or my assistant, whoever's helping me that day, and they're importing it into Lightroom, and I grab a new card and shoot. So the most I can lose on the wedding day is about 15 minutes worth of the shoot. It's just so scary that something could go wrong.
Suggestion on the for PC users on which software to try if you can't read it from Photoshop or Lightroom, and it's I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Fan viewer or IR fan viewer or something like that. IRFAN is the first part of it, and it is free, and it reads like all raw types that I've seen. I don't know how they keep it up or why it does it so well, but it's really, really good to be able to try to go and see photos that maybe are having trouble in any of the other software. So
great recommendation. All right, well, some interesting segments of the week. Thank you guys. We want to get on to our doodads of the week, but before we do it, I have to remind you about the China Workshop. Nick Page and I and Erica Kay and Brian McGuckin are going to Guilin, China next year in June. I'm so excited for this trip. I was just telling my wife today that, like, I think I might have to make this a yearly thing to go back to Guilin. I just fell in love with it. I've never been just real interested in Asia and visiting it for whatever reason. But when I got there last year to shoot, I mean, it was just incredible. It was tremendous. We're going to spend multiple shoots shooting the very famous cormorant fishermen, these older fishermen who, you know, fish with no shirt on. They're wrinkly. They're weathered on these bamboo rafts on the Lee River. And they fish with these birds that will, you know, fly out and catch fish. And they have their gas-powered lamps that we can go and photograph them. We'll be going through the tiny little ancient villages of Dashu to shoot the people there. I mean, the street photography is so fun, and I'm not even one that usually likes street photography. We're climbing up the top of mountains to shoot the amazing landscapes overlooking the Lee River. I mean, we are shooting China. It's going to be absolutely amazing. It's a small enough group with the four instructors that we can really tailor this workshop to the individuals. You don't have to be in incredible health because we can, you know, separate you into groups of people who have a similar skill level. You do not need to be an advanced photographer by any means. We're definitely going to have beginners there, and we'll have you in a separate group where we can take care of you and walk you through everything that you want to be walked through. We'll also, I'm sure, and I know some of the people that have signed up are very advanced photographers as well, and we'll have you in a group where you'll have people of like-minded skill levels learning the kind of things that you want to learn. It's just a tremendous experience. We've really done our best to keep the price down, but you know what? If you look at your finances and you find a way to save up a little bit each month, we have it broken into 3 payments. Find a way to get to China with me. That's going to be an amazing experience. I'll be with you for a whole week, as well as the instructors. Really looking forward to it. That's at improvephotography.com/China. That's improvephotography.com/China. At least check it out. It's just going to be an amazing, amazing trip. All right, let's get into our doodads of the week. I'm going to throw the first one over to you, Jeff.
So with the media shower, it has been a topic that we've had on the Photo Taco Facebook group. They've asked, what is the best wide angle lens on a budget? And so I thought I'd make that my pick today. And that's the Tokina 11-16mm f2.8 lens. Not the best wide angle lens by any stretch, but price for performance, it is hands down the best. So they have one for Canon and Nikon. It's a really good quality lens for about $400, which is pretty amazing.
That is a great price.
Yeah, so it's totally worth it if you do landscapes, if you want to do night skies, and you're a Canon or Nikon shooter, full frame or crop. It works for both, and it's really good.
Very cool. Good recommendation. Darren?
Mine's on the same trajectory as the comments that are heading our way, or I guess meteors, and mine is the SkyView app. And there's a paid version and there's a free version, and I'm still not sure what the difference is. I got mine paid because I'm a Starbucks addict, so that actually came through and they let me download the paid version for free. But it's really cool. I even opened it tonight and it actually alerted me about the meteor shower, and you can hold it up to the sky and even look through the earth, through the ground, to see what constellations are below you that you can't currently see. But applicable to tonight, you can actually see exactly where the Perseus constellation is, so you can point your camera in the right direction and hook up an intervalometer and just chill out in the nice air-conditioned car, or heat if it's cold in your part of the world where you're trying to view it.
Great recommendation. I'll download before I head out.
The one I like is called Sky Guide.
Sky Guide.
A little different one. That's the one that I've been using to do the same thing.
Okay, I'll check it out. Hey, Jeff, I want to make sure I heard something right in your recommendation. You said the Tokina 11-16 is just for crop, right? It's not a full-frame lens.
I guess so. For Canon, it's an EF mount. Oh, no, it's not.
I don't think that's right. I think it's just EFS. Just crop sensor. Okay.
Yep, you're right. It's EFS. Sorry. Cool. It is crop only.
All right. My recommendation this week is the Pixtor SD cards. So this is a really cool tip. I've been excited to share this one with you. So SanDisk makes, SanDisk and Lexar both make really, really good cards. And I found a way this week to save a ton of money on SD cards. So if you get a high-end card, you know, you're looking for a 64 gigabyte SanDisk card that, you know, is UHS 3, has all the speed features maxed out, you know, top of the line card. It's going to cost you in the neighborhood of $100 for a 64 gig card. But SanDisk also makes a little offshoot brand that they call the Pixtor line of their SanDisk cards. Guess what? It's the exact same thing. Nothing is different at all. And it's their brand, SanDisk's brand, that they make exclusively for Best Buy. So when you're going to buy a memory card, go to Best Buy, because you're going to get the exact same card for like $40. I picked one up at, say, I went to Best Buy this week because I needed a card, and I had forgot to bring an extra. And so I went in there and I saw Pixtor. What is this? And so I started doing a whole bunch of research, and sure enough, exactly the same card at less than half the price. And some people are selling them on Amazon that are buying at Best Buy and just selling it on Amazon. So check out Pixtor. That's P-I-X-T-O-R. They're the regular old SanDisk memory cards that are, a lot cheaper. So be sure to check those out.
And also for those who are rushing over to try to get a nice fast lens for wide angle shooting, I did a little quick research and it rang a bell. Our friend Tom Larkin, who joined us in China, just got the Rokinon 14 millimeter f/2.8, and it works for the Canon full frame system, and it has a great rating and is a very, very sharp lens. So I would also recommend that one.
Yeah, and Rokinon also makes a 16-1.4 that Nick Page likes.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's the one that Nick recommended in the Photo Taco episode about it.
Yep. Yeah, there are a lot of good ones out there. The thing with the Rokinon lenses is most of them, manual. Maybe even all of them, they're manual. Yeah. I mean, that means you got to actually spin the front of the lens to get it in focus. If you're an advanced photographer, that's probably fine. But for a lot of beginner intermediate photographers, you're going to miss a lot of shots while you're trying to figure out the manual focus stuff. Because, I mean, you can be off by a millimeter and it's just not quite as sharp as it can be. But a great recommendation for night photography. That's awesome to go with those Rokinon lenses. And Rokinon goes by other names in other countries. Samyang, it's the same thing.
Right.
They have a bunch of different names, but that Rokinon 16-1.4 is a great option as well. Good point, Darren. Well, thank you for joining us this week on the Improved Photography Podcast, and we'll see you in another 7 days.